So first, apologies again for any fermionic confusions during the talk on Monday. I hope all confusions were clarified on the afternoon problems. Today I want to talk about boundary conditions in A models. Both Davide and I, and possibly C, are sort of building different perspectives on boundary conditions for two-dimensional theories, which hopefully by the end of the week will upgrade to defects and boundaries in higher dimensions. Today I was a little bit torn. So there are parallel stories of sort of deriving what some physical boundary conditions look like for the A model and the B model in two dimensions. But even though the basic steps in writing down boundary conditions and analyzing them are superficially the same, there are sort of complementary difficulties and simplifications on the two sides. So the B model is very algebraic, as I'm sure you guys who have studied coherent sheaves know. On the other hand, so algebraic, physically, there are no instanton corrections in the B model. All the results are very clean and exact. Unfortunately, the fact that it is algebraic means that all of the interesting things are sort of stuck in singularities or in fermions. And if you want to describe boundary conditions as Lagrangians, you have to say they're like Lagrangians in a shifted cotangent bundle. And so they're Lagrangians in a sort of derived algebraic geometry sense. In the A model, boundary conditions are just Lagrangians in a nice geometric sense. And a lot of the geometry is clearer. On the other hand, there are caveats everywhere because almost nothing is exact. And there are corrections to worry about everywhere. That said, during the lecture today, I will talk about the A model, and on your problems this afternoon, you will repeat everything for the B model and derive boundary conditions there. That's the plan. There are a few more things to say about Durham quantum mechanics, which I'm going to do now. So last time we talked at the end of the lecture about one-dimensional n equals two supersymmetry, and Davide talked about it yesterday. So very quick reminder, the superalgebra looks like that. There's an action on superspace where one-dimensional superspace, 1D n equals 2 superspace, is R time cross shifted C. And with coordinates t, theta bar, and there's some action of the q's that looks like this. And the signs are all conventions. The signs in C's lectures are a little bit different. It doesn't matter. So there's a q bar that acts like that, and then there are d's and d bars. Right. So the D's generate their own algebra with the minus sign, and the D's commute with the Q's. And I talked a bit about general superfields that have an action of this algebra, and then smaller ones. General superfields give you reducible representations of the supersymmetry algebra, and there are several ways to reduce them. The one relevant for this talk, or the fields relevant for this talk, are going to be real superfields. Remind you. So a real superfield, big X, has a component expansion that starts with a real bosonic field and then a complex fermion and its conjugate and then another bosonic field. And it satisfies X is X dagger. And then we can work out the supersymmetry transformations of the components. And since they will play a role throughout this talk, I want to write them on the board. Put them up here. Let me make a little table acting on X, psi, psi bar, and F. We find that Q acting on little x gives us psi, Q acting on psi is 0, Q acting on psi bar is x dot minus F. And Q acting on F is psi dot, and then Q bar acts like this. Where did I get this from? Well, I just took this differential operator, acted on the superfield with it, then pulled off components. And a nice thing to check, for sanity's sake, is that the anticommutator of Q and Q bar really is 2 time derivative on any component. Okay, so from there, we can try to construct an action. For a single real superfield, the action looks like this. So this is analogous to what C was doing yesterday. He wrote down an action for chiral superfields in 2 dimensions that involved a Kähler potential and a W, a superpotential. And this is a simplified version of that. There are fewer thetas around, and there's less that one can do. I do, thank you. Absolutely. So the action looks like dt, d theta bar. And the kinetic term in superspace gets written as d bar x dx. And then one can throw in a potential in superspace. This thing is called a real superpotential. And it comes from a smooth function on a smooth real function on the target, where this R is really like it's the target of the superfield. So my MIX is a function from superspace to R sub X, and that's the R sub X I'm talking about, and hopefully that's all clear. Expanding this in components, we find the following thing. A standard kinetic term for the bosonic component, something that looks like a potential for, well, a potential with a weird inverted sign for F, and then an interaction between F and X that depends on the superpotential. And then there are fermionic bits. There's a kinetic term for the complex fermion, and something that looks like a mass term for the complex fermion, where the mass is X dependent. If this really were a mass, you would get what you saw in the problems from Monday. There would just be a constant here. If H is quadratic, then you really do have just a constant there. Otherwise, there's an interaction. So now we can write down the equations of motion. The relevant feature is that the equation of motion for X involves two derivatives. The equations of motion for psi m psi bar involve one derivative, and the equation of motion for F doesn't involve any derivatives. I'll write them down, though the precise form is not important. X double dot is F H double prime plus H triple prime psi bar psi dot is minus H double prime psi bar dot is H double prime psi bar, and finally F is H prime. Now, let me comment on this thing F. So physicists usually call F an auxiliary field. There are no derivatives of F in the action. Physicists would say you can integrate it out at the classical level. You can just solve its equation of motion. We can try to interpret that given what's been said in the past week and a half. In the algebra of operators, we work modulo the equations of motion. So we can just set F equal to H prime of X everywhere in the operator algebra. F itself never has to enter. Also, in the Hilbert space, remember this is a quantization of phase space, where phase space is solutions to the equations of motion on, as Dylan put it, a germ of a point. And Since there's no derivative for f, we don't need to specify any initial data for f at all. It's fixed in terms of whatever x is. So this doesn't contain f of 0. That's fixed in terms of x. The upshot, no matter how you want to look at it, is that the entire theory is equivalent to one where we solve classically the equation of motion. So equivalent quantum theory is obtained by just substituting in f is h prime. And then the action, just do it in different colored chalk. If you substitute that in, this entire piece becomes plus a half h prime of x squared. And maybe I'll write that somewhere up high as well. So the bosonic part of the action looks like dt half x dot squared plus half h prime squared plus fermions. Okay. Also, if you forget about the fermions, this is exactly the sort of thing we wrote down on Monday, where I used a real potential v of x. H prime squared is playing the role of that. Okay. Let's think a bit about local operators in this theory. I will restrict to polynomials, which is dangerous in Durham-type quantum mechanics for reasons that I might explain on Friday. Here, it won't matter too much. In Delbeau quantum mechanics with chiral superfields, there is no danger whatsoever in restricting to polynomials, and you will do it on the problems this afternoon. So from polynomials, we can generate local operators from x, x dot, psi, and psi bar. And we use the equations of motion to eliminate all higher derivatives. And then these operators inserted at points have the same short distance behavior as they would in a free theory and as we saw on Monday. So the difference between inserting x and x dots at nearby points is h bar, which in today and Friday, h bar is going to be set to 1. So from now on, and similarly, the fermions satisfy commutation relations like this. Close by, swapping the order comes at a cost of h bar, which is set to 1. And now that we have a supercharge in the game, we can ask for the Q cohomology of local operators. Let's see what this polynomial computation gives us. In general, once you take Q cohomology of local operators, you should no longer have to worry about exactly where you place them, because all time derivatives will end up being Q exact, precisely because this commutation relation trivializes Q on Q closed local operators. Q bar is the thing that trivializes Q. So let me just go about how you would do this, at least semi-classically, ignoring any more serious quantum corrections. We have that table up there. So Q of X, Q acting on the operator X is psi, and Q of psi is zero. So psi is Q closed, but it's also exact. X and psi are gone. Q psi bar is X dot minus F, but F is H prime. So psi doesn't seem to be in cohomology. And the next thing I might want to write down is Q of X dot to ask, you know, maybe is X dot Q closed? I can write down Q of X dot. It's not zero. You can figure out what it is. But Q squared is zero, and there's something very similar to X dot, which is closed, namely X dot minus H prime. And it's closed in a trivial way. So the upshot is that if we just, in our algebra, we replace X dot with X dot minus H prime everywhere, let's redefine our variables, the cohomology completely vanishes, or rather is trivial. The only operator around is the identity. So psi is gone, and X dot is gone, and everything is gone. So this, acting on polynomials, is just C. It's generated by the operator 1. That looks really boring. It's actually a sensible answer, because we'll see what the Hilbert space is first. Any questions? All right. So the phase space consists of initial values of X. I mean that.
But the cohomology is concentrated in degree zero.
I mean that's the caveat I'm carrying around, that I'm not looking at any more complicated operators. Right. So in Durham quantum mechanics with a non-trivial target, they're disorder operators. It is something I remembered last night while I was preparing this lecture and got a little bit displeased. And so I'm not talking about them now. But if you really want everything and you want the state operator correspondence to work and convolution products to work out, there are disorder operators around, which can be constructed from exponentials of things like x dot. So the phase space is something familiar. Phase space doesn't care about interactions. It just cares whether the equations of motion are first or second order. And so it's the bosonic and the fermionic copy of what you saw on Monday. Hilbert space should look like L2 of R. Tensor, an exterior algebra, and I can write elements of this as so my L2 of R is going to be, or the R here is going to be parameterized by X, and then elements in this space look like A plus B psi. And if we identify psi with a differential, then this looks like forms on the target, which here is just R. And our familiar operators act on it. So if we identify, if we look at the action of x, x dot, psi m, psi bar on Hilbert space, x acts as multiplication by x. X dot acts as derivative with respect to x. Psi, in our differential form notation, is wedge with dx, and psi bar is, well, it's derivative with respect to psi. That means remove a dx, which means contract with the vector field d dx in terms of differential forms. Right. And then we should figure out how our supercharge Q acts. And there are a few ways to do it. So actually, maybe there's one thing I should say that I didn't initially write down. So how does Q act on the Hilbert space? You might ask, why does Q act at all on Hilbert space?
When you've written down Hilbert space like that, that's because you've chosen a polarization of
space
with like x and c being the. Okay.
Mm-hmm. That's a particular choice of polarization. For the record, so at the end of this, we're going to find that Q is the Durham differential, but Q is the Durham differential in this polarization. If you had chosen another polarization, you would find that Q is d dagger, and maybe Q bar is the Durham differential, and things like that. So why does Q act on the Hilbert space? The first answer is that there's an associated Noether charge. Which is why you had problems on Noether's theorem. So we can find the Noether charge associated to Q. I'll write it as slightly scripty Q. So Q is a symmetry of the action, and there's an associated charge. It's x dot minus h prime times psi. And I could just proceed from there. Let me do it. So what I mean by this thing as an operator on Hilbert space is d dx minus multiplication by h prime of x times psi, translated into differential form notation. Actually, sorry, I think this is not important. I think to get my signs right, there's a little minus sign, oops, in front of d dx. Translated into differential form notation, that's exterior derivative, rather minus the exterior derivative, minus h prime dx wedge. In other words, that's minus e to the minus h d e to the h acting on forms. This is on forms on R. Now, I think for about half of you, this another procedure is still mysterious. So let me point out one relation that has to hold. We started off with an action on local operators that you throw into correlation functions. So we can consider an insertion of some local operator O and then act with Q on it. We know what that means. At least semi-classically, it's induced from the action on fields. And then we can act on the Hilbert space with this Q of O. The role of the Noether charge is that acting with Q of O on the Hilbert space should be the same as surrounding O with with the Noether charge above and the Noether charge below. Depending on whether it's bosonic or fermionic, it'll look like that. And then acting on H. And what I mean in equations is that acting on the Hilbert space for any operator O, Q of O should be the same as commutator in this Hamiltonian operator representation should be the same as commutator with Q, with the Noether charge Q. Does that make sense? And then you can use this, so this is guaranteed. And it's not just for Q, it's for any symmetry. It's guaranteed that the Noether procedure intertwines between action on fields or operators and action on Hilbert space. You can use this to figure out what the Noether charge should be, even without going through the entire Noether procedure. As in, you can just check that this thing commutes with any operator, thinking of the representation on Hilbert space or thinking about the small distance behavior. This thing commutes with any operator precisely in such a way as to generate the expected action of supersymmetry. So you can use this to figure out or to find. And I'm going to make another digression. In higher dimensions, the symbols that are written here as curly Q and Q the vector field play very different roles. Q the vector field is something that acts on fields and local operators. Curly Q the charge is a codimension one surface operator. And I feel like nobody has said it, so I'm just going to draw that picture. And this applies to supersymmetry or any other symmetry. So in higher dimensions, we have an action of a symmetry at standard Q on local operators induced from the action on fields. And so at any point in higher dimensional space, I can insert an operator and ask what happens if I act on it with Q. We also have, from the Noether procedure, a conserved current. Which is either a one form or a d minus one form, depending on how you view it. And so if I view it as a one form, then conservation means that d star j is zero. And then we can build a surface operator curly Q as the integral on any surface of star J. And then the relation is that vector field acting on operators should be the same as surrounding a local operator with this surface integral of star J. And what we're seeing in quantum mechanics is a low-dimensional version of this, where the link of a local operator is a zero sphere. In other words, two points with opposite signs, and then what you just find is a commutator. No. No. It's on the equations of motion, it satisfies that. That also means that as long as you restrict the equations of motion, it doesn't matter where you put the surface. It's a topological surface operator. Now, let me come back to the problem at hand. So back to supersymmetric quantum mechanics. If our target were compact, so here we have a single real superfield, the only compact target we could consider would be S1 rather than R. Then the superpotential H doesn't matter. In other words, well, it doesn't matter for computing Q cohomology. The cohomology of forms with respect to e to the minus h d e to the h is equivalent to the cohomology of forms with respect to D, in other words, to Dram cohomology. And that's the answer you should expect to get for the Hilbert space and the Q cohomology of the Hilbert space in supersymmetric quantum mechanics. We can generalize this construction to arbitrary Riemannian target. I realize this example is a little bit boring. So we can generalize to an n-dimensional Riemannian target Z, where locally we parametrize Z with n superfields Xi, and then the action gets written as a superspace integral of something like a half metric. Dxi, dxj is plus a half potential. And then we'll get exactly the same story. We'll get Q acting as the Dirac differential conjugated by e to the h. And if the thing is compact, it doesn't matter which differential you use. And you find that the Q cohomology of the Hilbert space is Dirac cohomology of the target, as in Matt's talks. On the other hand, if the target is non-compact, you have to be careful. And I'm being careful about this because it's what you need for the simplest examples of the A model. On a non-compact target, you basically have to use Morse theory. You formulate some argument that in the presence of a generic H, the cohomology of curly Q on the Hilbert space is the same as the cohomology of the Morse-Witten complex. So cohomology curly Q on the Hilbert space is cohomology of the Morse-Witten complex. And Matt went over this. Let me just highlight the results. One constructs, so what is this thing, the Morse-Witten complex? There's a vector space generated by critical points of H, as long as they are non-degenerate. And a differential coming from gradient flows. Differential from gradient flows. And let me, rather than actually defining these, I hope most of you know what the Morse complex is. Let me say where they show up here. The fact that there's a single ground state for every critical point of H comes from this potential. We have a potential V whose absolute minima are precisely at the critical points of H. So our potential is H prime squared and looks something like that with a bunch of minima. And one would expect a quantum particle to have some approximate ground state trapped in each minimum. These are the copies of C that are showing up in the Morse-Witten complex. Where are the instantons coming from, or the gradient flows? They're coming from here. They come from the observation that the Q fixed points in the space of fields allow configurations where x dot is equal to f. In other words, x dot is equal to h prime. In other words, we can have trajectories where, as we move along the line of time, x dot changes in a way that depends on the gradient of h. And so this is the standard picture where we start at one critical point and then interpolate to another one via gradient flow. And it turns out that these things are exactly the right corrections to the differential on this complex to compute that cohomology. Okay. That is the level of detail I'm willing to go into about that. I will give an example. If H is x squared, there's a single critical point, and the Q cohomology of the full Hilbert space should be equal to C if H is x cubed, maybe plus a linear piece. Then there are two critical points and a flow between them. And so the Q cohomology of the Hilbert space becomes equivalent to the cohomology of a two-term complex with a differential between the two terms, which is zero. Okay, and now I go back to the really, to the statement about the algebra of operators being really boring if we're considering this sort of quantum mechanics on the real line. On the real line, H either looks like this or it looks like that. The critical points either cancel out in pairs or one is left over. So these are the only two options for your Hilbert space. Local operators should be just general linear endomorphisms of this Hilbert space. the only thing you can possibly have is multiplication by a constant, which is what we found. So this is consistent with our trivial calculation that the Q cohomology of local operators just contains the identity. Okay. Great. Now let me do two dimensions. Let me start back over here. So I want to consider the A twist of a 2D 2,2 theory. In fact, a 2D 2,2 sigma model. So the A twist makes sense, or the A model makes sense for, in general, symplectic targets, but the 2,2 theory requires a Kähler target to be formulated, so I will stick to that. So we have a 2D sigma model with Kähler target that I'll call M. And our fields are maps from chiral superspace, as in C's talk. So there is V, N equals 2, 2, chiral. To M. More concretely, in local complex coordinates, M is parametrized by chiral multiplets. Where I goes from 1 to the complex dimension of M, and then there are the conjugates that appear as well, and I'm not going to repeat this because it all appeared in C's talk, in the first half of C's talk yesterday. The supersymmetry algebra in two dimensions, this is briefly repeating Davide's talk, is generated by four supercharges with commutation relations like this. The Q pluses commute to something like 2dz, and the Q minuses in Euclidean space commute to 2dz bar. All the other commutators are zero. And in here, there's a nilpotent supercharge that defines the A twist. That's Q plus plus Q bar minus. So this QA is zero. Now I want to go through three steps that that everyone should think of when they're trying to analyze boundary conditions. Step one is what Davide did. If we want boundary conditions that preserve QA, and a physical Suzy algebra along the boundary, we should classify one-dimensional supersymmetric subalgebras of two-dimensional 2, 2. In particular, we should classify one-dimensional supersymmetric subalgebras that contain QA. What I mean by a one-dimensional subalgebra is that it contains translations parallel to the boundary, but not perpendicular. So it turns out, as soon as you choose where your boundary is, there's only one such subalgebra. Don't think I need that, but we'll keep it up anyway. So if we fix coordinates, some Euclidean spatial coordinate S and some Euclidean time T, and require that the boundary goes along T and not S, then the only choice is a 1D n equals 2 algebra containing or generated by QA and something I'll call QA bar, which is Q bar plus Q minus. And you can check. And Justin did a few of these computations yesterday. So QA bar is in fact just time translation, doesn't have any space translation. If you rotate the boundary, you have to rotate the choice of Q bar. So this is a choice. And it depends on the boundary orientation. Right, that's step one. And now we've landed on some sort of one-dimensional n equals 2 quantum mechanics. Whether we land on Durham or Dalbeau-type quantum mechanics in one dimension is yet to be determined, and is the content of step two. Which supersymmetric quantum mechanics do we get? Well, we have to rewrite the entire two-dimensional theory as a 1D theory, as a one-dimensional supersymmetric quantum mechanics with charges QA and QA bar, such that the fields, or sort of the 1D target, looks like maps from the spatial slice S to the 2D target. This is a formal rewriting of functions on a space. In this case, what happens is that so go to the main example. If the 2D target in the non-supersymmetric sense, the Kähler thing, is C, then we have a single chiral superfield which has some very long expansion, but in particular contains a complex boson, that's the coordinate on C. This decomposes into two real superfields. For the one-dimensional algebra generated by QA and QA bar. And how do you figure that out? Well, you just start acting with QA and QA bar on the various components of this chiral superfield and see what the closed orbits are. And you get two of them. One is I'll just write them down explicitly because we're going to use them in a second. So there's a real superfield X and a second real superfield Y. They each have their own components. And the relation is that phi, the boson in the chiral superfield, is x plus iy. The fermions get linearly transformed. So there's some invertible linear transformations of the fermions that regroup them. And the auxiliary fields don't matter, and in fact, they get regrouped in an interesting and non-trivial way. This rewriting messes with auxiliary fields. It's allowed to, because the auxiliary fields aren't really there if you're not working in superspace. So the claim is that you can take this two-dimensional theory and rewrite it in terms of one-dimensional fields, but of course the one-dimensional fields don't just depend on T anymore, they depend on S. So this is X of S and T, psi of S and T, etc. The action looks like this. So the two-dimensional action in 2D superspace looks like dt ds, d4 theta, Kähler potential, which is just phi dagger phi. That is relatively clean. That gets rewritten in one-dimensional superspace. And it looks like this. So it's an integral, now just dt, d theta bar. Half, now integral ds along the spatial direction of a standard kinetic term for x and y, d bar x dx plus d bar y dy. And then a second term. So you might expect that if you take a free fields in two dimensions, you get free fields, in one dimension. And the standard, the canonical kinetic terms in one dimension look like this. But there's a problem. an integral over one-dimensional superspace can only produce t derivatives. It can't produce s derivatives. We know what the expansion of that is. It looks like the thing up there. And we need to account for s derivatives somehow. And the only place they can go is into a potential. And the only potential that we can write down in one-dimensional superspace is an h-term. The h-term ends up looking like this. It's a half integral over space x dsy. So this entire thing is the new h. Note a few things. So we could write h up to the half, which I'm largely going to drop. We can write it like this as x dy, or using an integration by parts, we can write it as y dx. This The if we plug that potential into the actual form of the 1D action and look at h prime of x squared, now dh squared, where h is this integral, is precisely going to give us the kinetic terms we're looking for. It'll give us a ds x squared plus dsy squared, which is great. We've recovered the 2D kinetic terms. Moreover, the auxiliary fields for x and y are related to derivatives of h. So remember that on shell. Once we solve the equation of motion for the f's, they're related to derivatives of h, and in particular, fx, that's dh dx, but now that's a functional derivative, and that becomes ds of y, and fy is dh dy after an integration by parts, that's minus dx. ds of x. So the normal derivatives get mixed up in supermultiplets with sort of the opposite real component. If we had considered a general symplectic target, we would see symplectic geometry appearing here. The thing that tells us how to pair normal derivatives in one direction or of one field with the supermultiplet containing the other field, that's the symplectic form. So for general symplectic Taylor M, if lambda denotes the level one form locally on M, so that d lambda is omega, then this h is an integral over the s direction of the pullback of the level one form. And so in our example, M was C, which was T star R, and the level one form got written as X dy, and this H is the integral of the pullback of the level one form. Now we should go to step three. How do you actually find boundary conditions? sorry, questions, comments, anything on step two? I hid it because I just said what the result was, but step two is where you see that the A twist in two dimensions has to do with Durham quantum mechanics in one dimension. It was a computation that when we decompose 2D multiplets in terms of 1D multiplets, we get real superfields. Could have happened a different way. And it does happen a different way in the B model. Oh, linear transformation. So the fermions just get juggled around. Okay. Now, step three starts with the following claim. The classical, at least, analysis of boundary of supersymmetric boundary conditions really boils down to making sure that the variation of the superpotential term containing normal derivatives vanishes. Or rather, that the variation of H has no boundary terms. In other words, it looks like an integral of it looks like an integral of equations of motion in a supersymmetric sense, which I'll clarify briefly in a second, with no terms on the boundary of space. At boundaries of S. Now, I guess the starting point is this, together with the fact that if we want supersymmetric boundary conditions, any constraints should be imposed on entire superfields. So that they're preserved by supersymmetry. Okay, so now let me say what this means in our main example. I'll again consider a half space that's S less than or equal to 0 times time, and let's look at our H. So H is minus integral on a half space. And I'll write it like this for the moment. Y dsx, the variation of H, contains two terms. There's variation of Y dsx plus y ds variation of x. And if we do an integration by parts, that becomes variation of y dsx minus variation of x dsy minus a boundary term. Minus y variation of x at 0. Okay, So the stuff multiplying variations in the bulk, DSY and DSX and DSY, are supersymmetric equations of motion. What I mean by that is that if you want solutions to the equation of motion that are also fixed under QA and QA bar, you will end up setting DSX and DSY to zero. And then we have that variation to deal with. And we can think of that in two ways. The textbook way of analyzing boundary conditions is to put constraints on X and Y so that this thing vanishes. And you can do that. You could say either set Y to zero or keep X fixed to any constant, and then it just doesn't vary at the boundary. That's totally fine. So we can impose by hand a classical boundary condition to kill this boundary term. And that's not just in supersymmetric theories, that's what one does in any theory. Even if we weren't playing in superspace. I'm not going to do that because there is often a more robust approach that also correctly accounts for quantum corrections. So you have an option. You can do both of these things, but I strongly prefer the latter. So we won't impose boundary conditions by hand. Rather, we'll let the action do it for us. What do I mean by that? Well, here, the boundary variation and the bulk variation have to vanish independently. And if we just set dH to zero, we'll find that y is zero at the boundary. And then we remember that y is a superfield. It contains little y, and it also contains the normal derivative of little x. This is sitting in the F term for Y. That's that relation over there. And so in one fell swoop, we get a pair of boundary conditions for the scalar fields. We find that there's a Dirichlet boundary condition on Y and a Neumann boundary condition on X. We also get all of the correct boundary conditions on the fermions to preserve supersymmetry, and we don't even have to write them down. Right. Now I want to try to interpret this geometrically. So what's happening? In terms of our target M, which was R2, we have found that just by writing the action this way with this form of H, that imposes dynamically a boundary condition. And it tells us that at the boundary, y is zero. The normal derivative of x vanishes, but x itself is unconstrained. Observation, this is a Lagrangian. So y equals zero. Is a Lagrangian in M. And that's not an accident, and this is how the Foucaille category starts appearing. Yes?
Can you explain what you mean by blows by hand? Do you mean expand y delta x in components and then set each component independently at zero? Or what else? What do you mean by impose by hand?
I mean don't impose by hand.
Yeah, but like, what I mean is, what aren't we supposed to be doing?
Oh, sorry. So you could have a priori just defined the space of fields that we're doing the path integral over to have some behavior at the boundary. And sometimes that's the only thing you can do, but in these supersymmetric examples, you can often do better. So like in Dylan's talk from maybe last week, earlier this week, Monday, there were intersections of Lagrangians happening. So there were a pair of Lagrangians, and one of them was a by-hand restriction on the space of fields at the boundary. And that had, if we did that here, it would have the property that this term would just vanish. And there would be several choices. We could have also set x to be a constant. And there are lots of other choices. Again, it may not be too important at the moment. It is for getting sensible quantum results and understanding deformations of boundary conditions and the sorts of things that David has been talking about. It's really useful to sort of start with a boundary action of a particular form and let the boundary action do the work for us. Because if I'm not imposing anything a priori on x, and I want the variation of h to be zero.
Right, I mean, I see why it imposes that from that equation, but from the geometry.
Sure, so let's.
Special about y equals zero?
Nothing. So let's fix that. So, how do we get more interesting things? So more generally, we can add a boundary action. So that our full action looks like standard kinetic stuff plus I'm not writing down the 1D superspace integrals. So standard kinetic stuff plus integral of y dx. And then we can throw in, I should really write it down. Well, do it outside. And then we can throw in some function of x at s equals zero, and integrates the entire thing over one D superspace. And now, if we ask for the variation for all of the boundary variations to vanish, so we have h, and then we have this boundary. This extra boundary interaction. The boundary terms will tell us that y is no longer zero. We'll find a y dx plus a g prime of x dx. In other words, y is equal to g prime of x. In other words, in terms of the leading bosonic components, little y, in other words, we find a Lagrangian that's the graph of dg. So now we can get something like this. Where the Lagrangian is y equals dg dx. And many more general things. So even more generally, I'll say it here. So more generally, we can introduce any 1D sort of real or Dram quantum mechanics at s equals 0. This is like Davide's picture, except we use hash to denote different things. So we can introduce, say, quantum mechanics with some Riemannian target z. In the bulk, have Kähler target m, and make the two talk to each other with one of these h-like terms, with the boundary superpotential, so that now the total action involves kinetic stuff minus that integral of y dx, and then any function of x and some real supermultiplet z. These are boundary superfields that make these things interact. So classically, we would say this produces for us a Lagrangian boundary condition cut out by the equations y is dg dx and dg dz is 0. These are the classical vacua of Dram quantum mechanics. This sort of thing can be used, for example, to flip the vertical line into a horizontal line. If we add just a single free real field on the boundary, so if our boundary target is R and G is quadratic, is X, Z, then you actually end up, with the y-axis as the Lagrangian. The quantum interpretation is more interesting, and one gets there are different limits in which one can make quantum sensible statements. I will end with just one of them. So quantum interpretation this is just to drive home something that Davide said. This is one in a situation like this, the boundary supports supersymmetric quantum mechanics on Z with Morse function for superpotential. G of X and Z that depends on parameters. As far as the boundary is concerned, we should not think of X as a dynamical field, but rather as some sort of constant that we can dial. And so we'll get a boundary Hilbert space. It's H curly Q of the Hilbert space of this boundary quantum mechanics that is derived the same way it was derived in lecture, but this thing is now fibered. Over values of x. And from this perspective, what we actually build is, in, I think in general, a constructible sheaf over over this very simple Lagrangian along the x-axis. A very simple example of that is where it's just a local system. And so, for example, you could use this procedure to start with any Lagrangian, say even one thrown in by hand, something funky like this, and then on top of that, couple to extra boundary quantum mechanics, and in a very simple way, that will produce for you a local system on top of that Lagrangian. And one starts seeing aspects of the Foucaille category. I haven't told you how Hams are computed. I would have liked to. But I'm totally out of time. So that's that. Thanks. Oh yeah, it's because of the way I wrote the action down. And I didn't say it, but I chose a particular way of writing this y dx term. I could have written x dy. As far as the, like, if there's no boundary, those two are completely equivalent. There's an integration by parts, but if there is a boundary, it matters. And writing it as y dx favors the horizontal x-axis. In general, you can, So if you want to approach this a different way, you say you know that you're supposed to get the Foucaille category and its objects are Lagrangians. So let's try to impose an arbitrary Lagrangian boundary condition. You will actually find that you need to add extra terms to the action in order for the action with that by hand boundary condition to not have any boundary variations. And at the end of the day, you get to the same sort of thing. Like if you tried to write down a crazy graph Lagrangian like this, and say, okay, it's Lagrangian, and so therefore just the naive, you know, that should be a good boundary condition. Therefore, the naive action should not have any boundary variations. That is false. You will find that you actually have to add this g. I did.
In real life, you know, the Foucaille category is most interesting for compacts.
Totally. So I did an analysis in local coordinates and mapped out what boundary conditions look like locally on the target, where I can think of it as a cotangent bundle, and write this thing as PDX.
Objects in the Foucaille category
you're saying for every single object, the sort of action for which that object is a boundary condition is different.
Yep.
Like they're all objects in different quantum field theories or something?
No, the bulk theory is the same. And so they're objects in the same category. The only difference is a boundary term. So the bulk A model is always the same. The difference is just that things get added to the boundary action.
Can you just say again what the plus g of x at s equals
It's only supported at s equals 0. So it's an extra potential on the boundary, and it's part of the data of a boundary condition.
It's a function like, on the boundary.
Yes. So from this perspective, I would say if you're trying to figure out like what your category of boundary conditions is, you can start populating it with objects that are labeled by real manifolds and functions g. yes?
And we have boundary conditions that the Lagrangian submanifold is not exact. I mean,
that was sort of my question.
Yeah, so that's an issue of gluing things globally over the target. I am sure you can from other ways of looking at the Fukaya category and work that was done over the past two decades. I have not checked to make sure all the coordinate transformations will work out just right. I suspect they will, but I don't want to make that claim.
Well, obviously, you won't because you're using a Liouville form here, which doesn't exist globally on the manifold.
That's fine. The potential, if you look at what the actual action is, it involves the derivative of this H. It's like Kähler transformations in C's talk, where he was gluing, like, obviously the Kähler potential doesn't exist everywhere, but there are Kähler transformations that relate it. And the way one writes down a sigma model or a boundary action is locally on the target and then glues together coordinate patches. So possibly, and I'm not sure what correct things to say about that right now. Any other questions? Thanks.